What is the meaning of life? There is perhaps no more provocative question to begin a sermon. What is the meaning of life? Theologians and philosophers have discussed and debated this for as long as recorded history. In fiction, when Watson asked Sherlock Holmes about the meaning of life, Holmes replied, "What is its meaning, Watson? What object is served by the circle of misery and violence and fear? It must tend to some end, or else our universe is ruled by chance, which is unthinkable. But what end? There is a great standing perennial problem to which human reason is as far from an answer as ever." And Holmes is right. Despite thousands of years of consideration by the greatest minds, human reason has not been able to come up with any consensus as to the meaning of life. Philosophers have dealt with the meaning of life in various ways. Going back to the 5th century BC, the Greek philosopher Plato, who was a student of Socrates, taught that the meaning of life was to attain knowledge. Another of Socrates' students, by the name of Aristippus of Cyrene, developed the doctrine of hedonism. Hedonism is the denial of the Platonic idea that meaning of life comes through knowledge, but is instead teaching that the meaning of life comes through physical pleasure, enjoyment of the senses. According to hedonists, any regard for law or custom is not found in any intrinsic good in the law itself, but rather is found in the fact that if you violate the law, it will result in unpleasant physical consequences. Aristotle agreed. He said that men seek primarily pleasure, but he said there had to be a balance in this. There needs to be a balance between pleasure and deferred gratification. Hedonism was modified in the 4th century BC by Epicurus, who did not believe in anything supernatural. He believed in only that which is natural. He believed that the greatest good in life would come from seeking modest pleasures. He was not looking into revelry or wanton sexual lust, but rather in friendship or virtuous temperate living. Likewise, around the same time, the Stoic philosophers believed the meaning of life is found in freeing oneself from suffering. So the Stoic philosophers said that meaning of life was found in clear judgment and mental fortitude. That is an inner calm. That if you diligently practice this inner calm, logic, reflection, concentration, you will come to the meaning of life. Today, modern psychologists say that delayed gratification is the key to the meaning of life. That there is a greater reward if you wait for the temporal future. Of course, they don't believe in an eternal future, but there's a greater reward if you delay your gratification now for the future. They tell us that children who learn to delay their gratification end up scoring higher on tests and being more successful in life. But long before any of these men, long before Epicurus, long before Plato, long before Socrates, there was Kohelet. If you remember, Kohelet is the preacher, the author of the book of Ecclesiastes, who we believe to be Solomon. Kohelet put all of these philosophies to an experimental test. He weighed them all. And there is perhaps no more thorough, clear teaching on the question of the meaning of life than is found in this section that we're going to look at today in the book of Ecclesiastes. In it, we're going to walk through the conclusions of this old preacher, this one man who lived out these philosophies. He tested them. He put them to the test. And we're going to see the only logical and realistic conclusion that the end of any pursuit under the sun lands you. Wherever, it's the only logical conclusion. The preacher's lengthy search for meaning in life comes to a simple and honest answer that we'll see in our text. Our text this Lord's Day is in chapters 1 and 2 of the book of Ecclesiastes, and it begins following the opening introduction that we covered last time. After briefly introducing himself and his mission in verses 12 to 15 of chapter 1, it goes into an autobiographical narrative of Solomon's search for meaning in life under the sun. We find a summary of his conclusions to each of four social experiments then. He's going to take on four experiments. First, searching for meaning in wisdom. And that's in chapter 1, verses 16 to 18. Secondly, searching for pleasure, searching for meaning in pleasure or hedonism in chapter 2, verses 1 through 11. Thirdly, seeking a balanced moral life, seeking meaning in a balanced moral life. And that's in chapter 2, verses 12 to 17. And then fourthly, seeking meaning in future reward, that is posterity, the future generations, looking to the future generations. And that's in chapter 2, verses 18 to 23. And at the end of it all, the simple conclusion in verses 24 through 26 of chapter 2. If you'll remember, the first 11 verses of chapter 1 served as an introductory poem. It painted a picture of life under the sun, that is, life apart from the knowledge of God. It leaves us with a rather bleak and pessimistic but realistic picture of life. The toil of our work, endlessly working, busily working with no prize in the end. People never changing, always the same. Our senses constantly being fed and fed and fed, but never being filled. Working and working with nothing to show for it. Humanity as a race, living out our lives from one generation to the next, never learning, repeating the sins of the past, forgetting the good of past generations. Kohelet, the author of Ecclesiastes, has painted from the very beginning a picture of a world that is lost in hopelessness. On this unending hamster wheel, running around and around and around, scurrying around with no progress. Well, now we come to a section, it's the longest section that we'll be dealing with in the book of Ecclesiastes. But we're going to see this focus now sharpen. From these paintings and analogies in the opening poem, Koheleth now is going to teach us from his own life experience. And he begins in verse 12. Look with me with chapter 1, verse 12 and 13. He identifies himself and his mission. He says, I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem. And I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under the sun. So this is who he is. He identifies himself as Kohelet, the preacher, king over Israel. He uses the first person here. He's saying, I, the preacher. This is going to be an autobiography. Kohelet, though, is older now. He's going to relate his firsthand experience from his younger days to teach the younger generation what he has learned. All that he himself has personally searched out, utilizing the wisdom that God gave him. We learn from his excesses. We learn from his failures. We will learn from his sins. We will learn from his common sense. We will learn from his God-given gift of wisdom that he's going to apply and teach us now. And brethren, none of us here have been endued with the wisdom of Solomon. Not a one. And although, in fact, there's only one man who was ever wiser than Solomon, and that is the Lord Jesus Christ. And although it seems the younger we are, the more we think we know, it would benefit us greatly to learn from this old preacher. This man nearing the end of his life, teaching us so that we would not repeat his errors, so that we would live by what he has already learned. In his usual candor, Kohelet is quick to tell us the worst, right off the bat. He doesn't mince any words. He doesn't hold back the conclusion. Look at verse 13. This is his conclusion. He said, it's an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. What is this searching, this using of wisdom to find the meaning of life is an unhappy business for him. And while he's not happy, he knows that God has given him this wisdom so that he would conduct this social experiment so that we might learn from it. Is it true that all is vanity? All is a vapor. If anyone is qualified, To answer that question, it is the wise Solomon who is given all the resources to put these things to the test. Here is a man who had everything to test these four ideas, these four philosophies. He begins by giving us the conclusion again in verse 14. He says, I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and striving after wind. All that takes place in this world under the sun is vanity. Remember that word vanity means a vapor. It's like trying to grasp hold of wind. You cannot figure out life apart from God. It leaves you with nothing to grasp, nothing to hold on to. And all the greatest minds that have tried to figure it out, the most brilliant philosophers, if you compare their notes, you will find nothing in common because they all have different ideas. The meaning of life is incomprehensible by the best human reasoning. And why is that? Because the meaning of life begins with God. And if He is not factored in to one's understanding, if one is not beginning with God in their understanding, the best of solutions by human wisdom will turn out to be utter folly. Paul says in Romans chapter 8, the entire creation is subject to vanity, to futility, to vanity, by the will of who? By the will of Him who subjected it, namely God. The world was created by God, and when Adam fell into sin, God subjected the world to futility. He cursed the ground with thorns and thistles. He gave tornadoes and hurricanes and typhoons and diseases and viruses and cancer and backaches and all of these things. And we cannot understand these things. They make no sense to us. They seem crooked to us. They seem unfair and random. So Kohelet considers the questions of life. Why, when a tornado comes down a road, does it wipe out one house and leave the very next house untouched? Why are some people destined to get cancer and others not? Why are some left childless while others are given many children? Why do some of the most diligent workers lose their jobs? Kohelet is grappling with these questions of life that make no sense. And he says in verse 15, what is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. You can't straighten out these injustices with your human mind. You can't figure them out. The whole idea of searching for meaning in life is an unhappy business to him. Because he is so wise, because he could see reality. He doesn't just kind of like look the other way, make believe things aren't going on. Because he is so wise, because he has been given eyes to see by God, he is even more burdened. It seems at times that those who know less are happier. Saw a recent interview with film director Woody Allen, and he was talking about the meaningless and the emptiness of life. And he spoke of two characters in his film that he'd done. I forgot which film it was, but he was speaking about these two characters in his film. And he said, these are the kind of people that I would make fun of at a party. But yet he admitted at the end that they were nevertheless people who were a lot happier than he was. It's been said, ignorance is bliss. The more we know, the more we wish we didn't know under the sun. And this is Kohelet's first conclusion as he seeks for the meaning of life in wisdom and knowledge with all of the education he has. This is his conclusion. Look at verses 16 through 18 with me. Chapter 1. He said, I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me. And my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceive that this also is a striving after the wind. For, verse 18, in much wisdom is much vexation. And he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. See, Plato didn't get this. Plato said, more knowledge, you find out the meaning of life. Plato apparently never discovered what Qoheleth did. According to Plato, the best thing in human life is to pursue wisdom. And we see this philosophy today. We see it all around us. We see it in so many contemporary quotes about the meaning of life that I looked up on the internet. Things like, the meaning of life is to expand one's perception of the world, to follow the clues and walk out the exit, to learn as many things as possible, to know as much as possible and about as many things as possible. You know, this is the theology of Mormons. The Church of the Latter-day Saints teaches that God first created human spirits with the potential to progress toward perfection, and he put them on earth to gain knowledge. And through experience and through knowledge, they would attain their next level. But what Plato missed and what the Mormons miss, what they fail to realize, and what Qoheleth discovered, is that the very wisdom that they increase in only serves to make them more aware of pain and suffering in life. The very wisdom that they're increasing is the wisdom that life is painful. You see, wisdom is concerned with the pursuit of truth. And truth compels us to admit this. Truth compels us to admit the reality of suffering. Truth compels us to admit that nothing on earth is permanent. Truth tells us things are decaying. Things are getting older. Things don't work the way they used to work. Truth tells you that today you're one day closer to the grave than you were yesterday. That's truth. And the more wisdom and the more knowledge you have, the more you understand that. And that's the irony of truth. The more you know about the meaning of life, the more despairing you become about life. And others have made this same discovery. Atheist philosopher and writer Albert Camus said that you will never be happy if you continue to search for what happiness consists of. You will never live if you're looking for the meaning of life. Woody Allen, speaking about his perspective on life, said, I have a very grim, pessimistic view of it. I do feel that it's a grim, painful, nightmarish, meaningless experience, and that the only way that you can be happy is if you tell yourself some lies and deceive yourself. If you look at life too honestly, too clearly, life becomes unbearable because it's a pretty grim enterprise. Man by the name of Leonard Wolf authored 20 books on politics, economics, literature. He concludes in his autobiography, after 57 years of living on this human anthill, I would have accomplished the same thing had I played ping pong instead of sitting on committees and writing books and memoranda. What Wolf and Woody Allen and Camus share in common, in addition to their honest view of life and their accurate view about life under the sun, is that they leave God out of the picture. Their conclusions are made solely of life under the sun. So my brothers and sisters, learn from Qoheleth. Learn that as you seek wisdom and knowledge in life, do not glory in that wisdom. The greatest of human educations will leave you empty in the end. You know, they may even leave you wishing that you'd never learned what you know. Princeton, Harvard, Yale, Brown are meaningless because they present a philosophy that excludes God. And your highest and your best education will never bring about happiness, will never bring about meaning or purpose in life. As Plato's philosophy gave way to the hedonistic philosophers of the next generation, Qoheleth now turns in his experiment to seek meaning in life from wisdom to pleasure. Maybe the hedonists are right, he thinks. Is there meaning in life found in the selfish, lavish living? As contemporary quotes suggest, that meaning in life is found in chasing one's dreams, doing what you love to do, expanding your potential in life, becoming the person you always wanted to be, becoming a better you, striving for power and superiority to master and rule the world, to extend life or die trying, to adapt, to evolve. Is that the meaning of life? That's the philosophy of Shintoism. Shinto wants life to live, not to die. And Shintoism sees death as the pollution of life. And the ultimate victory is manifested when the human life is prolonged forever. Well, Kohelet puts Shintoism to the test, and Kohelet puts hedonism on trial in his life. Look at chapter 2. We'll look at the first 10 verses together. He says, I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also is vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of pleasure, what use is it? I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, but my heart still giving me with wisdom, and how to lay hold of folly till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks, and I planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of the growing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I had also great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and of provinces. I got singers of men and women and many concubines, the delight of the sons of men. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me, and whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was the reward of all my toil. Kohelet here is making a deliberate test. He's deliberately taking a flight from rational thinking, and now he's saying, I'm going to put pleasure to the test. He's not doing this merely to seek pleasure for himself, but rather to put pleasure on trial, to put hedonism on trial. Of course, he was before the philosophy of hedonism, but the idea existed long before Aristippus the Cyrene. He's asking, does hedonism provide the answers to the meaning of life? Is there any intrinsic good found in physical pleasure in the human existence? And he tests it. He tests it in the realms of comedy, wine, architecture, art, money, music, entertainment, and sex. He's testing this. He becomes for a season like the wanderer in that U2 song, where he says, I went out there in search of experience, to taste and to touch and to feel as much as a man can before he repents. He takes on this test to see what is pleasure going to give me in the end. And whatever his eyes wanted, he pursued because he had the means to do it. He made great works, he built houses, he planted vineyards, he made gardens and parks and all kinds of trees and pools. He's making this new secular Garden of Eden, a Disney world of sorts, a grand display of his creativity and strength, such a brilliant achievement that anyone would look at it and say, yes, this man has found the meaning of life. Surely this man is fulfilled by what he has made. Like Charles Foster Kane and Orson Welles' Citizen Kane, he created an empire for himself. Xanadu, built of 100,000 trees and 20,000 tons of marble, a palace of paintings and pictures and statues, enough for 10 museums. The narrator of Citizen Kane tells us that they were like the pyramids, Xanadu, like the pyramids, the costliest of monuments a man has ever built to himself. But like Citizen Kane, for those who know the movie, Kohelet would not be taken in by all of it at the end. To him, in the end, it all meant nothing. Look at verse 11. All that he has tested of pleasure, verse 11, this is his conclusion. Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had expended in doing it. And behold, all was vanity and striving after wind. And there was nothing to be gained under the sun. The end of his life, Charles Foster Kane died right on his bed in the middle of his kingdom fortress, with a little snow thing in his hand, probably worth about 50 cents. And he dies and it crashes to the floor and he says, Rosebud. What was Rosebud? It was a child's sled that was fit to be burned. It was burning as junk. A child's sled. All that he had, vanity, striving after wind. And what he cares about most in his last breath, his moment of death, a sled that was burning as junk. Indeed, there is nothing to be gained under the sun. So, brethren, do not glory in what your hands can do. You may have been given great gifts. Young people, you may have been given wonderful gifts. And you know what? You may have been given great vision. And you may have been given great purpose in life. You may have been given the grace of initiative to use your talents for great things one day. You may even make a great name for yourself. But do not glory in that. Do not boast in it. Do not live for that end, because that end will perish and everything else on earth will perish, and it will leave you with nothing in the end but a bitter disillusionment if you live for that. And brethren, understand there is in the pursuit of righteous pleasure nothing wrong in and of itself. The problem here with Kohelet is that he came to this conclusion because he sought this pleasure apart from God. But as we will see, there is a right kind of enjoying the simple pleasures that God does give us, and we'll come to that in a bit. So he strikes out with wisdom. He strikes out with experimental hedonism. Perhaps he's going to now find the answer in religion or in morality. He's going to contrast wisdom with folly now. People do this all the time. They look for meaning in life in some way. Maybe when they were younger, they lived their immoral life, and now they're going to do wisely. Now they're going to straighten things out. They're going to turn over a new leaf. They're going to live a good moral life. They're going to adopt some children from a foreign country. They're going to give lots of money to charities or whatever they're going to do and straighten it all out morally. They don't know quite where God fits into this, but you know what? I want to be a moral, good person. Is there meaning in life in that? Can living a life of making good, wise choices bring meaning? Let's see how Kohelet describes this test in verses 12 through 14. So I turned to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. Then I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, and there is more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. Earlier, Kohelet was merely seeking for meaning in life just using his wisdom, but now he's comparing wisdom with folly. And he comes to some sense here, as people do, again, nearing the end of their life, when they're looking to, maybe for their good works to outweigh their bad, they realize, you know what? There isn't so much joy in living a selfish life. Let me start and consider others. Let me start to do good. Let me think about leaving something of value behind when I go into the next life. This philosophy is summarized by experimental physicist Dr. Mikio Kaku, who wrote about the meaning of life. He says, the meaning of life is trying to leave the world a better place than when you entered it. As individuals, we can make a difference, whether it is to probe the secrets of nature, to clean up the environment, to work for peace and social justice, or to nurture the inquisitive, vibrant spirit of the young by being a mentor and a guide. This is the secular humanistic idea that human purpose can be determined apart from God. Humanism seeks to affirm our responsibility and our ability to live ethical lives, to aspire for the good of humanity, to strive for the common good. And we hear it in quotes, things like, the meaning of life is tied to leaving the world a better place than when you found it, giving more than you take, end suffering, seek equality, challenge oppression, distribute wealth, live generously, live responsibly. Is there any value to these ideas? Kohelet did discover the fact that there is more gain in living wisely than in folly was evident. He says it's as clear as light and day. Yes, there is more gain in living wisely than in folly. It's like a man who walks in light and a man who walks in darkness. Well, maybe he's finally getting there. Maybe he's finally found something about the meaning of life. Is there something in wise living that will reveal the meaning of life to him? We can all agree with this, right? We can all agree that living in wisdom is superior to living like a fool. But does it mean anything at the end of the day? Look at verse 14, in the middle of 14 where we left off. He says, and yet, I perceived that the same event happens to all of them. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart that this also is vanity. For the wise as of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance. Seeing that in the days to come, all will have been long forgotten. How the wise dies just like the fool. Under the sun, all the wisdom in this world is going to be taken with you into the grave. So what's the point of being so wise? When the wise and the fool end up dead, doesn't this waste all of my wisdom? What good is it if one day I will not exist and my wisdom will no longer exist? So Kohelet now comes to the conclusion that in light of this reality, look at verse 17. He says, so I hated life. I hated life. This is what it comes to. This is what the philosophies of this world bring you to. I hated life because what is done under the sun was grievous to me. For all is vanity and striving after wind. You see, from a secular perspective, if you try to understand this world on the terms of human philosophies, on your own terms, you will hate life in the end. You will hate all that is done under the sun. It will be grievous to you. You study philosophy. You research the world religions. You take self-improvement courses. You read self-help books. In the end, it will be vexation and frustration. The wisdom of the wise, Isaiah says, shall perish. All human pretension and human wisdom will be proven empty as God is glorified in confounding man's wisdom with his wisdom. 1 Corinthians 1:27, God chose what was foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. He does this because man tends to glory in wisdom, in strength. And God is a jealous God. He said, I will not share my glory with another. So he confounds the wisdom of the world. Kohelet realizes that all of his wisdom is going to go into the grave. So he comes to the only conclusion under the sun that he could in light of this. I hate life. Life is meaningless. Nihilism, the idea that life is without objective meaning. And that's the only logical end apart from God. Without God, that is the end. As Henry Miller wrote, life has to be given a meaning because of the obvious fact that it has no meaning. Or as Woody Allen said, it's a grim, pitiful, nightmarish, meaningless experience. So in the end, does Kohelet's test of religion and morality reveal anything? Does his understanding of right and wrong tell him anything about the meaning of life? Well, it might have helped him, might have guided him maybe to make some right decisions. But in the end, it did nothing to show him the meaning of life. And neither will the claims of morality satisfy your soul. Neither will the claims of living and loving good and trying to be the nicest religious person that you could be. It will do nothing for you. You can give up everything to benefit others. If in the end it is not to the glory of God, you will end up hating life. Are you near hating life? Be honest. Perhaps this is the problem. You will wish that you had not lived that way. You'll say, what good was all my moral upbringing? What good was all this religion? I'm going to end up in the grave right next to the fool. This is why in the end all the major religions fail, because they tell you how to live. They tell you what you should do, the rules of morality, the guides of wise living. They will all end up empty. They may offer help and guidance temporarily, but they will do nothing to give your life meaning. We come now to the fourth and final test. Qoheleth looks to future generations. What's going to happen after I die? Maybe the profit and gain of my life of toil will be useful after I die. My children, my children's children. Maybe all that I'm going through will benefit them. Maybe that's the answer, but he quickly closes the door on that. He recognizes that it's a waste. He's hating his toil. He's only to face the reality that whoever gets all of what all of my toil has brought could be a fool that will squander it. Look at verses 18 to 21. I hated all my toil which I toiled under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool? Yet he will be master of all for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity. So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun, because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. Now listen, there is nothing wrong with the idea of wanting to see your children taken care of. Proverbs 13:22, it's a godly pursuit to leave an inheritance. It says a good man leaves an inheritance for his children's children. But we can't live for this. You can't find your meaning in your children. You cannot live merely for the future generation. This is where the psychologists who talk about all delayed gratification put it all off. This is where they're wrong. Not only is there no joy in living merely for the temporal future under the sun, but the reality is that it's risky business because you never know when you're going to die and when that's going to be handed over to a fool, when they're going to take your money and all that you work for and squander it. How they're going to take the business that you manage so carefully and ruin it. The consideration of this reality blows your hope out of the water. Even spiritually, brothers and sisters, you can invest your life into someone, a person in ministry who can become apostate, or worse, who can turn others away from the faith. This is the reality of life. We can spend our energy building a non-compromising church together. And the next generation could come in and make it a religious harlot in a matter of no time. This is reality. And if we do not see God's hand working in the midst, it can become very discouraging. It could become paralyzing. We can understand Qoheleth's lamentation when he says, I hated this. I turned about and gave up my heart to despair. Look at verse 22 and 23. What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. Even in the night his heart does not rest. This also is vanity. He sees the restlessness, the hopelessness of life, seeking meaning apart from God. And brethren, as much as we love our children, and as much as we ought to seek the best for them and good for them and spend time training them and spend time discipling a next generation, as much as we ought to be concerned about the next generation of our church, we cannot live merely for a temporal future. You're never going to find satisfaction if you put all of your effort and time and energy into your children or your children's children, because they will disappoint you. This is the reality of life. Don't think you're the exception. So what then is the meaning of life? If it's not found in education, pleasure, money, morality, religion, or even in investing in future generations, is there anything at all that is worth living for? Is there any meaning to life? Or is Stephen King right when he says, you discarded most of the lies along the way, but held on to the one that said life mattered? Is he right? Be assured, Qoheleth is not a nihilist. He is not a defeatist. There's a purpose in what he's doing here. There's a purpose how he is instructing us. And that purpose is that he would take us to the point where we would share his disillusionment so that he might bring us to the point of understanding a reality. He wants to bring us to the place of the despair of living this kind of life so that you can see what he's going to teach now. He's going to show us now why he went through all those experiences. The preacher's four experiments to discover meaning in life have failed. What's his conclusion? Is there no meaning in life under the sun? Let's read it together, verses 24 to 26, chapter 2. He concludes. There is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat? Who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting, only to give to the one who pleases God. This also is vanity and striving after wind. What's his conclusion? Carpe diem. Seize the day. That's his conclusion. Seize the day. Enjoy the moment. Under the sun, enjoy the moment because your ability to enjoy that moment is from God. Now I ask you, is that a satisfying solution to you? Can life under the sun be that simple as enjoying the moment as a gift from God? If not, then I would ask you, what is your solution? Have you ever found meaning in life in knowledge or pleasure or religious morality? Or looking to the future apart from God? Why is it that this seems unsatisfying to us? Is it too simple? It's like Douglas Adams, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. He asked this enormous supercomputer. He says, what is the answer? The ultimate questions of life and the universe and everything. And it takes 7.5 million years to figure out the answer. And the answer is the number 42. It's like, that's it? This is it. This is the meaning of life under the sun. That's a contemporary illustration, and there are others, of the very same conclusion that Solomon arrives at here. Life under the sun. He put it to such a thorough test. He tested everything. And he puts on his secular glasses. And he sees very sharply what others have seen. You've heard the quotes. He sees it very sharply. He sees the restlessness of life. Many men and women have attested to this. You heard the quotes, Woody Allen, Stephen King, Douglas Adams, Henry Miller, Albert Camus, Leonard Wolfe. They are all atheists and they are all absolutely right. They have a more accurate understanding of life than Joel Osteen does. Let me give you two more quotes. 200 years ago, another atheist, German statesman Johann von Goethe, said the human race is a monotonous affair. Most people spend the greatest part of their time working in order to live. And what little freedom remains so fills them with fear that they seek out any and every means to be rid of it. And what von Goethe is saying here, although from a secular standpoint, he's trying to motivate people. He's saying life is monotonous and the only things you don't do are the things you fear. Life is filled with it. So live for the day and don't fear the future. A couple of weeks ago, the actor Jim Carrey was doing this commencement address. He said this, he said, all there will ever be is what is happening here. Again, realize this is under the sun. All that will ever be is what is happening here. And the decisions we make in this moment, which are based on either love or fear. And he went on to talk about his father who took the safe route in life, didn't become a comedian, but became an accountant. But he lost his job when the actor was 12 years old, and he concluded from his father's example at the end, and he charged the graduates saying, you can fail at what you don't want, so you might as well take a chance on doing what you love. Well, Koheleth comes to the same conclusion. The same conclusion. But there's one big difference. Koheleth traces it to the will of God. Look at verse 24. There is nothing better. There's nothing better under the sun for a person that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is what? From the hand of God. That word enjoyment there means to find good in. You see, under the sun, the world, in their work, what do they find good in their work? Friday afternoon, Friday evening. Thank God it's Friday, they say, right? Thank God it's Friday. But here, under God's sun, the very toil that tyrannized him with its meaninglessness, he sees as a gift from God. And he finds it a source of great joy. So while the world is saying, thank God it's Friday, you can say, thank God it's Monday, or any day of the week. Because God created all days for his people to enjoy. This is from the hand of God. I remember when we were renovating the building. Remember, Mike, when we were renovating that building in Haledon? Still aching from it. Day after day, it was excitement. Right? It was excitement. We saw those who were part of it and painting and coming in every day. And it was hard work for sure. But there was joy as we saw progress being made. We were turning a gym into a church meeting room. Well, I'll tell you right now, everything, Mike, everything you did is gone. Everything you and Matthew and I and all of you, everything you did, it's all gone, and it's handed over to a Romanian Orthodox church. True. Now, some people came up to me and said afterwards, see, it wasn't God's will that we go to Haledon. It wasn't God's will. Really? Really? Does the end tell us anything about the means? Is that right? Was the toil for nothing? That's not what I get from Koheleth here. According to Koheleth, the end of something tells us nothing about the value of the means, at least on a temporal level, in time. You know, we're wired to look at things this way. If we're teaching a Bible study, let's say, and no one shows up to the Bible study, we say, oh, that was a wasted effort. But what about all the joy that you have in preparation of the Word? Or you go out evangelizing. You go out in the streets, you go to the abortion clinic, and no mothers turn around, or no one is saved from your preaching, and we think, oh, we failed. But that's not what I get from Koheleth at all. Brethren, when you evangelize, whether you're preaching at Kessler, or standing at the abortion mill, or handing out tracts on the street, enjoy the moment of it. Don't worry about the fruit. You plant, you water, you trust God for either the increase or the lack thereof. Because you know what? God is going to do what is according to his good pleasure, and we cannot look at the end of something and try to figure out the means. On Sundays when we gather together, enjoy the moment. Enjoy each other. You know what? There's going to be a time. There's going to be a time when one Sunday someone will be here, and the next Sunday they will be gone. They'll go to be with the Lord, and you won't see them again in this life. That's going to happen one day. Enjoy now. Enjoy the moment. Embrace one another. Love one another. Enjoy the time you have with one another. The simple things of life, rightly used, become sweet and good to God's children. Not for Woody Allen, not for Stephen King, not for Albert Camus, but for God's children. Look at 25 and 26 again. Look at verse 25. He says, for apart from him, apart from God, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? You see, you can't. Woody Allen, Stephen King, Albert Camus cannot enjoy life. They cannot even eat in enjoyment because it comes from the hand of God. Apart from God, how can you? Look at verse 26. For the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. This is your birthright as a Christian. Joy is among your birthrights as a Christian, and God has given you that each and every day to take pleasure in. Whether it is your wife, or your husband, or your children, or your school, or your workplace, enjoyment is there for you, brother or sister. It is there. If you pursue enjoyment for your own pleasure and your own end, it's going to vanish like the wind. But if you enjoy it as God's gift, you're going to be refreshed. Food, drink, work are a few examples. Later on in chapter 9, he's going to talk about marriage and your dress, your garments, and the wife that you love. And he talks about whatever your hand finds, do it with all your might. Go for the gusto, they used to say. Just do it, I think, is the way they say it now. Even money, when it's not a god, is for your enjoyment. As 1 Timothy 6:17 says, for the rich in this present age, charge them not to be haughty, nor to set their hopes on uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly provides us with everything to enjoy. If God has given you something, enjoy it, my brothers and sisters. Learn from old Kohelet, who would tell you, life is short, seize the day, don't worry about temporal tomorrow, for you know the one who holds your future on this earth. Live to love more, to treasure more, to seek beauty in what God has put around you, to enjoy it, to love others as best as you possibly can. And don't be so uptight and wound up. That's not what the Christian life ought to be. Instead, you ought to fulfill your purpose today. And I believe the reformers had it right when they said the meaning of life is to enjoy God forever. To glorify God and enjoy Him forever. Well, let forever start today. Fulfill your purpose today. Enjoy God today. You don't have to wait for Friday to thank God. You can thank Him in your toil for the little joys, a walk in the sunshine, a smell of a flower, a pillow to lie your head on, a delicious meal. You can open the window and you can let breath into your lungs. That's a gift from God. There's the smile of a friend. When you see a bird flying in the air, remember, your father fed that bird and he's going to take care of you as well. Life any other way is meaningless. And if you go day by day by day, as this generation has, with their heads down, despairing and in depression and anger and hatred, you know what you are? You're living like the world. With all the despair and depression that's going on in the world, you look more like a worldling than you do like a Christian. My old pastor used to say, some Christians look like they were baptized in pickle juice. You are just like the world, snubbing God's daily gifts to you that He has given you to enjoy. Paul said it this way in 1 Corinthians 10:31. Whatever you do, whatever you eat or drink, whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. You say, but that's something still missing here. Yeah, there's eternity and there's lots of sermons about eternity. This is about life under the sun. This is how you live your life now. Why should I be concerned with these things? Because they're temporal. Because God is concerned with these things. Your hair is not going to be around for eternity. Okay? Some of us know that already. But you know what? He still cares. He still has them numbered. He cares enough about a sparrow hopping around on the ground. He cares about the details of your life. So don't ignore the detail of the ordinary, because God is in the ordinary of day-to-day things of life, and you're missing Him. We tend to think of God in the crisis. We tend to think of Him in the hurricane or the earthquake, and we forget that He is in the gentle breeze. So stop looking for the magnificent supernatural manifestations of God and see God as just as magnificent in the equally supernatural natural things that He brings into your life every day, and enjoy them, for they are from the hand of God. Amen. I'll just add as an addendum. Originally, I thought this message was more for the unbeliever than the believer. It turns out I believe the message was more for the believer than the unbeliever. If you are not in Christ today, you cannot enjoy the things of this world. It is impossible for you to enjoy the things of this world. If you are not in Christ today, the most realistic view of life is that life is meaningless. All that you think you live for ultimately is vanity. So I would urge you, if you're not in Christ, to come to Christ today, to believe on the Lord Jesus Christ, to repent of your sins, turn from them, and turn to Christ. And He will give you meaning, and He will give you joy, because those things are only from the hand of God.